Hello and welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Catherine Brigantino, and I'm your host for today. I'm joined by Steve Romanin, who is teching the show. A big thank you to Steve, because without him and his technological knowledge, Animal Voices could not happen. He's nodding in appreciation. Today's show is inspired by some wonderful victories for animals that happened last week when Toronto City Council voted to both send the Toronto Zoo's three surviving elephants to a sanctuary in California, as well as ban the possession, sale, trade, and distribution of shark fin in Toronto. We will be speaking with Claudia Lee, founder of Shark Truth, and Nick Wright, a founding director of Lawyers for Animal Welfare, about the shark fin ban. But first, we have the pleasure of talking with Julie Woodyer. Julie Woodyer is the campaigns director at Zoo Check Canada, and the last time she was on the show was to talk about the ongoing case of Lucy the elephant, who has been confined at the Edmonton Valley Zoo for over 30 years. Lucy's story is a tragic case of neglect and abuse, and Zoo Check has been one of the organizations that has taken up Lucy's case and is still pushing hard to get Lucy taken out of the Edmonton Valley Zoo and into a sanctuary in the U.S. Animal Voices is happy to welcome Julie Woodyer back to the show, but this time at a moment of celebration. On Tuesday, October 25th, the Toronto City Council voted to send the Toronto Zoo's three surviving elephants to the Performing Animal Welfare Society Sanctuary in California. Welcome back to Animal Voices, Julie Woodyer.
Thank you.
First of all, I'm wondering if you can tell us about the surviving elephants at the Toronto Zoo and why I say surviving and why there has been such a struggle to have them moved.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yeah, the three remaining elephants that are there are Theka, who's 31 years old, Aringa, who's 42 years old, and Toka, who's 41 years old. They've all had a series of health problems that are typical of elephants that live in cold climates, including foot problems, as well as gastrointestinal problems that result from a lack of exercise. Obviously, our cold climate is quite harsh for these animals, and in fact, the Toronto Zoo has had a number of deaths at their facility, including four individuals who died all around the age of 40. So the two older girls in this case would be at probably near the top end of their life if they were to stay in Toronto. Mm. Now, they're not old elephants by any means. I don't mean to suggest that. It's just that elephants age quickly in our cold climate because of the health repercussions.
How long do they live in the wild?
African elephants live up to 60 years old in the wild. Of course, they would stay with their families for most of their lives. The bulls would maybe go off, but the females would be staying with their families for their whole life. And just in a note that Iringa and Toka were born in Mozambique, and they were taken out of a cull there and to be shipped to the Toronto Zoo, whereas Theka was actually born here.
And what do you mean by a cull?
In Africa, there have been various culls of elephants, and when they go in and kill the adults, they snatch out the babies and bring them to various zoos. Mm. In fact, before we got the zoo to agree to send the elephants away at all, they were talking about trying to acquire more elephants out of the wild.
So why then the struggle to have them move to a sanctuary and not another zoo that is accredited by the Canadian Association of Zoos and Aquariums?
Well, the sanctuary just offers so much more that no other zoo can possibly do. It's essentially like a retirement facility for elephants. The Paws Sanctuary offers 80 acres for each species of each, the Asians and the Africans. Mm. They have a big jacuzzi in the barn for the African elephants. The key, though, to all of it is that the elephants will be able to make choices about how they want to spend their day. They'll never be locked inside the barn. They'll never be locked out of the barn. They can graze in the pastures 365 days a year. The zoological facilities can't offer that, even though the AZA is building what we call an elephant farm in Florida on some 225 acres, they're still going to just break it up into little small paddocks, 4 and 5 acre paddocks, and keep the elephants there, which is why we're calling it a farm, because essentially they're just setting it up as a breeding facility.
So the Canadian Association of Zoos and Aquariums can't adequately provide elephants who are in captivity, can't provide them a standard of living that's acceptable. I mean, what can a sanctuary do that a... what in particular can a sanctuary do? You mentioned a jacuzzi. That sounds lovely.
Yeah. Well, Here's the thing. First off, it should be noted that AZA accreditation really has nothing to do with guaranteeing a good facility. For instance, 18 of the 39 facilities that keep African elephants at AZA zoos are still using bullhucks, of all things, to train their elephants. Of the other 21 other AZA zoos that don't use bullhucks, vast majority of them have really, really small space. But like I said, the key for the elephants is that the sanctuary will offer them freedom of choice. They can choose where they want to spend their time on this 80 acres. There's ponds and lakes and meadows and forested areas. And, of course, a heated barn and the jacuzzi. and they can choose who they want to spend their time with. You know, there's always these arguments that are made by zoos that elephants are antisocial. It's something they've said a lot about Lucy in particular. And there's been some arguments about these elephants in Toronto having had some conflicts with each other. But that's the point about having space, is the elephants can get away from each other when they're not feeling social. And they can come together at the times when they are feeling social, and thereby it creates a more naturalistic environment, and the elephants have an opportunity to heal in that environment.
For listeners that haven't heard the interview about Lucy, I'll put a link up on the podcast to that interview to bring you up to speed. It's an excellent interview. But for those of us that haven't heard that interview and don't know about Lucy, can you tell us a little bit about her case?
Well, Lucy is a lone elephant, and she's in the most northern facility anywhere in North America. Lucy suffers from obesity, arthritis, constant foot problems, and infections. In Alberta, we actually have zoo standards that we don't have here in Ontario that require that animals be kept in appropriate social groups, among other things. And, of course, a lone elephant, a lone female elephant in particular, is not considered an appropriate social group. So that zoo is actually violating the law, which is why we're taking that case to the Supreme Court. But Lucy's situation is tragic, and unfortunately there they won't allow any independent experts to come in to assess her or to help her. And the only person that they have brought in is a veterinarian who has a long history of trying to facilitate keeping elephants in bad circumstances, including circus environments.
So what about this decision to send the three remaining elephants at the Toronto Zoo to Paws Sanctuary? Do you anticipate this decision having a positive effect or positive implications for Lucy, who's still stuck at the Edmonton Valley Zoo?
I would certainly hope so, but already the officials in Edmonton have said that they don't care what's happened in Toronto. They're not concerned any further. They feel that they've done what they have for Lucy, and she's going to be stuck there until the court makes her leave.
What do you anticipate happening? Can you suggest a timeline? Like, where is ZooCheck in the process?
Well, we're heading to Paws Sanctuary this weekend with two of the counselors, Councillor Berardinetti, who put forward the motion, and Councillor Cho, who's been advocating for the elephants to go to the sanctuary at the zoo board level. So we're going to go there, introduce them. Councillor Cho will bring back a report to the zoo board because, of course, this is still an important issue to the zoo board. And then Ed Stewart will come up to Toronto in probably a week or two from now, and he'll bring in a vet and probably a trainer from Active Environments, and they will assess the elephants to see what their condition is, what training has already been done, what needs to be done. They'll start the permit process, which takes anywhere from 60 to 90 days, and they'll figure out what is the best time frame in which to move the elephants.
Very exciting. I saw the ZooCheck News email. ZooCheck has requested that folks concerned about the elephants and happy to see them being moved to a sanctuary write a letter of thank you to the counselor. So I just wanted to take a chance to remind people that if you haven't done that, please do so. It is very important to acknowledge your support of this decision by the City Council. Julie Whittier, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to take a short break and come back with Nick Wright, the founding director of Lawyers for Animal Welfare. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Animal Voices here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I am joined by Nick Wright, who is a Toronto-based lawyer and one of the founding directors of Lawyers for Animal Welfare. Welcome to Animal Voices, Nick Wright.
Thanks, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Before we actually get started talking about the shark fin ban, I'm wondering if you can tell listeners that have never heard of Lawyers for Animal Welfare a little bit about the organization.
Lawyers for Animal Welfare is a Canadian-based registered charity, and our objects are to educate the public on animal issues and to work towards enforcing existing laws. And as part of our educational mandate, that can include both educating the public, but also educating organizations and people involved in government and policymaking on both animal issues and how to implement various policies.
Can you tell us more about the details of the shark fin ban? I know there's some confusion about whether, what a municipal ban can cover and what a federal bill would. And maybe if you could tell us more about what the consequences for those who break this bylaw would be.
Sure. I don't know if your listeners are aware, but shark finning is a practice of catching a shark in the ocean, cutting off its fins, and then dumping the usually live shark back into the ocean, where it either slowly suffocates to death or is preyed on by predators. So it's a very cruel practice. And the fact that many sharks are caught using long line fishing, where a long line is put into the ocean that basically scrapes the ocean floor, catches all sorts of bycatch, makes it even more concerning. And it's a real problem from an ecological perspective, because sharks, by some estimations, have been decreased in number by 90%. Hmm. And sharks play a very important role in the ocean's ecosystem. So this is both an animal welfare issue and an ecological issue. But to come back to your question around the difference between the various levels of government, as everyone I'm sure is aware, we have three levels of government in Canada. We have municipal for cities, we have provincial for all the provinces, and then territories are similar but different. And then we have federal, which takes on a different sphere of powers. And very generally speaking, the federal government takes care of issues that affect the nation as a whole, whereas provincial issues affect the various issues that arise at a provincial level. And then municipal issues, generally speaking, address issues that focus on the municipal sphere. So one issue that arose was people saying that, no, this isn't a municipal issue. This is a federal issue that should be addressed at the federal level. But a lot of people are saying that, no, what happens at the local level, what happens at the global level are interconnected. And I think what we're seeing is a change in perspective and a change in attitude about how what happens outside of the city of Toronto or any other city has a direct impact on the city of Toronto and other cities. So the old adage, I think, sums it up well: think globally, act locally. And that's what people have been doing on the shark fin ban and more with other issues.
Can you tell us about the details of the ban? What exactly does it entail?
Well, the ban in Toronto prohibits the sale, consumption, and possession of shark fin. So it's a fairly comprehensive ban, and it's one that ensures that the city of Toronto doesn't permit or promote the finning of sharks.
What about concerns about loopholes and how to regulate and enforce the ban? Is there concern that without a federal ban on importing in general in Canada, the municipal ban will drive the product underground or perhaps even increase its value?
Well, currently federally, there is a license prohibition on the finning of sharks. So there's the Fisheries Act, which is federal legislation that governs our fisheries. And then there are regulations under that act. And one of the regulations allows the Department of Fisheries and Oceans to put clauses in the licenses for various fisheries that stipulate what they can and cannot do. So currently with a number of fisheries, there's a clause on those licenses that says that when you bring sharks back, you can't have more than 5% of your total weight in the form of shark fins. And the idea being that shark fins generally constitute 5% of the shark. So they want to prevent people from taking the fins and dumping the sharks back in the ocean. And that's something, but, you know, there's still the concern about people shopping around for bigger size fins than dumping the old fins back in the ocean. But what it doesn't do at the federal level is prevent sharks that are finned in international waters from being imported into the country. So it doesn't prevent the problem on a global scale. So that's where there's been a lot of interest at all different levels of government to oppose the ban. We've seen some interest federally. Finn Donnelly of the NDP has started raising the issue. Elizabeth May of the Green Party is speaking out about the issue. But we haven't seen the same sort of pickup that we've seen at the municipal level. And that could be because of the current conservative majority. But at the municipal level, we've seen municipalities take a strong stand against finning. First Brantford in May of 2011, then Oakville in July, Mississauga in October, and Toronto on October 25th. So we've seen other levels of government take the stand in opposition to shark finning, and hopefully the federal government will follow suit. But as you say, it is just a municipal ban, so it's only inside the city of Toronto that shark fins will in fact be banned.
So what do you anticipate the effect of the ban in Toronto being, I mean, if it can't completely eradicate shark fins from being cut off from sharks in the oceans?
Well, people have raised the issue of enforcement, stating that the municipal level doesn't have the same sort of criminal powers that the federal level of government has. So you need to go to court and get a warrant if you're going to search premises outside of the restaurant inspections that are currently permitted. But I think that concern overlooks the fact that, you know, even if someone may have shark fins in their home, that doesn't mean the ban isn't worthwhile. Because what it will mean is that when you go to restaurants that currently sell shark fins, and I'm in a neighborhood that has quite a few of these restaurants, they're no longer going to have it on the menu. It's no longer going to be promoted, and it won't be nearly as accessible. And I think that that's the first step to moving away from the use of shark fins in soup.
I just wanted to return to the debate over whether a municipal ban on shark fin could stand up in a court of law. Can you tell us more about the role that lawyers for animal welfare played in providing legal opinion to city council?
Sure. So both the Mississauga and Toronto legal departments are reported to have expressed concern about the municipal authority to pass such a ban. And while neither permitted anyone in the public to read any opinion that they may or may not have put together, after doing a fairly lengthy investigation, a number of supporters for Lawyers for Animal Welfare came to the conclusion that it is, in fact, within municipal jurisdiction, and it can be within municipal jurisdiction under three different headings. Firstly, under the ability to legislate on animals, including their welfare. Secondly, on public health and safety, because shark fins have been found to have high concentrations of heavy metals, including mercury, which are very harmful to human health.
And why is that?
Sharks are high up on the food chain, so heavy metals like mercury and other toxins accumulate up the food chain. So, you know, one animal eats another, and something eats that, and then this heavy metal stays and works its way up. So the higher up the food chain you go, the more likely you are to have high concentrations of these toxins, like PCBs and heavy metals. So shark fins have been found to have high levels of mercury, which is highly toxic. So that makes the prohibition fall under the public health and safety category. And I think consumer protection is also a category of the municipal powers that it can fall under. People need to be protected from this toxic product. But also, there's an argument to be made, I think, saying that people want to be protected from contributing to destroying our oceans, on which Toronto depends. So in our opinion, it is, in fact, within municipal jurisdiction. And this was also echoed by another lawyer who helped draft the City of Toronto Act, who's a very experienced municipal lawyer. He was also at the deputations and had a separate opinion. So I think it's fairly clear that it is within municipal jurisdiction. But, you know, I could only speculate as to why the legal departments expressed caution, perhaps just a conservative outlook. Or also one other explanation could be that in 2001, there was a change in the Municipal Act of Ontario, and the City of Toronto Act governs Toronto, but the wording is essentially the same as it pertains to this issue. And since the 2001 amendment in the Act, municipal powers have been much more broad, but they haven't fully been tested. So I think a lot of the concern stems from the fact that while municipalities do now have a broader jurisdiction, that broader jurisdiction hasn't fully been tested in the courts. So there's some cautiousness and hesitation in implementing these policies that haven't been tested under the broader jurisdiction that was granted in 2001.
You mentioned that health and safety concerns and consumer protection concerns really carried some weight in arguing that the ban was within municipal jurisdiction. I'm just wondering, what about the sharks themselves? Does that have any weight in court, their interests at all?
Well, as I mentioned, one of the municipal powers is to legislate on animals, including their welfare. Mm-hmm. That's what's stated in the act. So I think that, yes, there is definitely municipal grounds to legislate where animals are being harmed. So the argument that some made was that these sharks aren't being finned in the city of Toronto. Therefore, it's outside of a municipal purpose and it's not within municipal jurisdiction. But I think that's an outdated perspective, the idea that what happens in our oceans isn't intimately connected with what happens in our cities. So I think that attitude is starting to change and people are recognizing that, you know, the maxim, think globally, act locally, applies, and that what happens in our cities and what happens in our oceans and elsewhere are intimately connected. So that's a perspective that I think is slowly changing as people become more aware of the interconnectedness of the world.
Yeah, well said. I'm wondering why was this shark fin ban winnable in Toronto? Why Toronto? Why now?
I think it was winnable because we have some really strong municipal councillors who spearheaded the issue, recognized it as being important, recognized it as being something that Torontonians are concerned about, and went the extra mile to make sure that it passed. And Glenn de Merrymaker and Kristen Wong Tam are two of those councillors who really stepped up to raise this issue and to do the work surrounding bringing forward this sort of motion.
Now, Mayor Rob Ford voted against the ban, and my understanding is that he argued that he doesn't want to be told what to eat, and he's therefore not going to support a bylaw that tells others what they can and can't eat. How would you respond to Mayor Ford's argument?
Well, you know, there's certainly the concern about government overstepping its bounds and imposing unnecessary or unjustified rules on how people can conduct their lives. I certainly can sympathize with that. I think that in this situation, those who understand the threat to our oceans and the cruelty inherent in the practice of shark finning, those who have that understanding of the practice wouldn't share that view and would instead think that it's better to ensure that this practice stops for the benefit of everyone. So I understand the kind of philosophical basis of that concern. But I think that certainly everyone that I've spoken to who has a deep understanding of this issue doesn't share that perspective and thinks that in this instance, it's something that governments of all levels should be legislating on.
We just have a few minutes left here. I'm wondering if you can tell us about what's on the horizon for Lawyers for Animal Welfare. What other cases are you working on and what should we expect to hear from you guys?
Well, Lawyers for Animal Welfare has a number of different campaigns on the go, and you can visit our website at www.lawyersforanimalwelfare, and you can sign up to our mailing list to get updates. But the shark fin issue is one that we're going to continue to work on. Toronto has passed the ban, Brantford, hopefully Pickering soon, Mississauga, but there are a number of other Ontario and Canadian municipalities who want to follow suit. So working with people who are trying to implement those bans to assist them, I've heard that Hamilton has raised some of the same concerns. Certain councillors saying that it's outside of their jurisdiction and some of these same old arguments that all the municipalities that have passed the ban have rejected. So the battle is far from over. Also at a provincial level, trying to have a provincial ban, and then at a federal level, a prohibition on the importation of shark fins are all next steps. In terms of other campaigns, we have an ongoing conscientious objector campaign where we assist students at the post-secondary level assert their right not to harm or kill animals. We've been working on the Air Canada monkey transport issue and are hoping that there'll be a positive resolution in that.
Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. Some time ago, an employee leaked the fact that Air Canada has been shipping monkeys for experimentation from China to Canada. And there's a lot of concern raised about that. And when it was brought to the attention of Air Canada, Air Canada responded saying that they were legally obliged to do so, because previously when they tried to prohibit the shipment of animals destined for experimentation, the shipper took it to tribunal and Air Canada lost. But after doing some research, lawyers for animal welfare found that Air Canada can in fact change their tariff at any time after the requisite 45-day period has expired and implement such a ban. They just have to change their own rules and stick to those rules. So we've been working with Air Canada and a number of other groups trying to come up with a positive resolution, and we're hopeful that there will be such a resolution in the future. So that's been a campaign that we've been working on recently as well.
Thank you so much for joining us, Nick Wright. You were listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. And we just spoke with Nick Wright from Lawyers for Animal Welfare. If you would like to find out more about Lawyers for Animal Welfare, I will have a link available on the podcast. Thank you again, Nick.
Thanks, Catherine.
We're going to take a short break and come back with Claudia Lee, the founder of Shark Truth, a grassroots nonprofit dedicated to promoting awareness, education, and action for sharks. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Animal Voices here on CIUT 89.5 FM. We are joined by Claudia Lee, the founder of Shark Truth, a grassroots nonprofit dedicated to promoting awareness, education, and action for sharks. Claudia Lee, welcome to Animal Voices.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. For those of us that aren't familiar with your organization, can you tell us why you founded Shark Truth?
Well, I'm a Chinese Canadian, and I grew up in a pretty traditional Chinese family, I would say. And growing up, I've had probably 50 bowls of shark fin at least. And I never really thought about how the shark got from the sea to my bowl. And when I watched the movie Sharkwater 2 years ago, I was appalled at how little I knew. You know, I considered myself to be somewhat eco-aware, but I never questioned about how my food got on the table. So it was basically that moment, or that night, I couldn't sleep after watching the movie. Mm. And then a couple friends and I got together, fundraised a bit of money. And then, you know, we had a very general mandate of promoting awareness, and one thing led to another. And 2 years later, we have 65 wedding couples who pledged not to eat shark fin at their wedding banquet, totaling to nearly 10,000 bowls of shark fin that hasn't been consumed, which just saves about 1,000 sharks from being eaten.
That's excellent work. I'm really happy to hear that. Now, in regards to the Toronto ban on shark fin, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about Shark Truth's role, what Shark Truth's role was in supporting that ban in Toronto.
Yeah, so it's a bit of an inspiring story. Joanna Hui was one of the wedding couples in this year's wedding contest. So every year we run this annual wedding contest called the Happy Hearts Love Sharks, and that encourages wedding couples to not serve shark fin. They send in a photo, the one with the most votes wins a trip to swim with sharks. And so Joanna sent in an entry, and she's from Toronto, and she ended up volunteering for us for a little while because she was kind of inspired by Shark Truth's work. And then she ended up working for the city councilor, De Bearmaker, that pushed forward this motion to ban shark fin. Mm. So in that sense, we kind of inspired, you know, one individual to go from just becoming a contestant to, you know, kind of watching her transform into this shark activist, which is really exciting for us. And so we supported her in whatever way she needed. And we also helped deliver 10,000 signatures to the city council on the last day of the vote.
10,000 signatures to support the ban?
Yeah.
How? How did you collect 10,000 signatures?
We partnered with change.org, which is an online platform, and they're really fantastic. They have a great list of supporters that are very willing to take action. So we did a lot of our own promotion, but partnering with them really gave us that leverage.
Mm. Now, in an article that you wrote for the Vancouver Sun, you said that the Chinese culture is one that is rooted in the values of nature and balance, and that the practice of shark finning and shark fin consumption simply does not fit. Can you tell us more about the traditional significance of shark fin in Chinese culture and why you argue that it simply no longer fits?
So shark fin is a status symbol, and it goes way back to the days of the emperors. It used to be a dish of the emperors, and that's how the emperor used to, you know, show off to his guests, hey, look how wealthy I am. Mm. I can afford to risk the lives of my workers to serve you this dish. Mm. And so shark fin itself is actually just a chicken and ham broth that's thickened, and the fin actually has no taste but just texture. The reason why people eat it so much is because of this kind of ingrained status symbol. So it was especially for weddings that shark fin is important. It's part of something called the Big Four in Cantonese cuisine, and that includes shark fin, abalone, fish swim bladder, and sea cucumber. And if you're really wealthy at a banquet, you'll have all four dishes. Mm-hmm. But at a wedding banquet, they used to say that a bride marrying into a family without shark fins marrying to a poor family. Mm-hmm. So there's that second layer of symbolism around, you know, having face and showing respect to your guests, similar to how, you know, at some North American dinners, you would expect turkey at the table, right? So there's that aspect of it. But, you know, there's a positive aspect around the concept of serving shark fin, which is that in Chinese culture, one thing that my parents and my grandparents always taught me that is that Chinese people have this kind of virtue of sharing your wealth and being generous. And so this is one way of the parents or the grandparents saying, you know, I've worked really hard my whole life. I've brought myself out of poverty. Look, I can finally afford this dish and share it with you all. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's that positive aspect. But what we tell people is that, you know, you can be generous without emptying a sea. So, mm-hmm. So it's just that the point is that a lot of people don't know about this issue. And it's just similar with me, which is why we started Shark Truth. And so having started Shark Truth, I'm going back into kind of my history in regards to my family and my heritage, and I'm learning a lot more about Chinese culture. And if you look at things like Chinese medicine, Chinese exercise, there's something called Tai Chi or Qi Gong, and all those things have to do with this idea of balance, of yin and yang, of not having too much, of not taking too much. And so I think we've become very far removed as a society in general, not only within the Chinese culture, but in developed nations in general, that we should be taking a lot. And that's what matters, is like dollars and material wealth, when we need to remind ourselves that as long as we have our health and good family and friends and have balance in our own lives, in many respects, that can lead to real success.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying makes a lot of sense to me. There's definitely the symbol that the shark fin represents generosity and sharing. And you're sort of taking this to a next level and really examining that tradition and suggesting we can be generous and sharing in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, especially at weddings, right? Like, instead of giving wedding favors that nobody is ever going to use again, why don't you put a dollar donation or $2 donation per person towards a charity or something that you care about, right? Mm. You know, that's even a better way of showing your generosity, because it shows that you have a social conscience. And, you know, in this day and age, we have so many issues that we're faced with, whether it's climate change, shark finning, ocean acidification, poverty around the world. There's so many groups that need that support. And I think that's a brilliant way of showing your generosity.
On that note about, you know, the many different issues that are intersected with shark finning, can you tell us more about why we should care about sharks in the first place? We just spoke with Nick Wright from Lawyers for Animal Welfare, and he told us a little bit about the ecological implications, but I'm wondering if you can tell us more about why should we care about sharks?
Well, sharks in general as a species are a very misunderstood group of animals, thanks to Steven Spielberg's Jaws and, you know, the many negative media portrayals of shark attacks. They've been a very animal that's been feared and an animal that's very under-researched.
Well, and you said even, you know, the history of emperors sending out people to get these fins from dangerous animals, right, as an emblem of status. So
yeah. That's exactly, you totally hit it on the head. And so there's that one aspect, is that sharks are very feared and under researched when, you know, in reality, you're more likely to get crushed and killed by a falling vending machine than you are by bitten by a shark. And
I love that analogy.
On average, less than 4 people die every year around the world from shark attacks. And considering how many people go in the ocean, that is very, very minuscule. It's literally, excuse the pun, but a drop in the ocean, right? Mm. So sharks are, in that sense, are, yeah, very under research. And secondly, they are top predators, which means that like bears, like wolves, they maintain the health and the balance of the food system. And for sharks, in this case, it's the ocean ecosystem. And the oceans make up over half of the surface of our Earth and provide us with a lot of the oxygen that we need. And so removing sharks that have been here for literally over 400 million years before dinosaurs even roamed this Earth, you know, sharks truly have shaped the ocean and the Earth's ecosystems, which we all depend on. So that's the important role they play. And they're being finned at a rate that continues to grow every day. Up to 73 million sharks are killed every year, mainly for their fins. And because their fins are worth so much money and everything else relatively little or nothing at all, they're often just taken for their fins, which, you know, is decimating the populations. Mm.
So with a rate of 73 million sharks killed every year, is that correct?
Yes.
To what extent is shark finning fueled by demand in cities like Toronto?
Well, 95% of shark fin consumption it remains in Asia. And Vancouver and Toronto and San Francisco are all big cities in North America that consume shark fin. California is the largest body outside of Asia in terms of a Chinese population. Vancouver has about 430,000 people, so 21% of our population is Chinese. Metro Vancouver has a smaller percentage, but they have about 600,000 people. Mm. So, you know, relative to the rest of the world, people might look at North America as marginal, but it's important to make change here because we have the ability. And number two, when we make change here, we're able to build the momentum for change abroad. So in Hong Kong and in China and in Malaysia and in Taiwan. So in terms of consumption overall for Canada, we imported 77,000 kilograms of sharks in 2009. And that can range, you know, anywhere between 500,000 to 1 million sharks. So we're still consuming a big number.
Hmm. I have to ask, the issue of cultural discrimination comes up and has come up in much of the popular discourse about the shark fin ban. How do you respond to the claim that it is cultural discrimination to ban shark fin, since it is seen as such an important part of Chinese cultural tradition?
Yeah, that's a question that I've been struggling with for the past couple of weeks, to be honest, because at the end of the day, this is an ecological issue, not one that's necessarily cultural in the sense that, you know, we're trying to help ecology, not attack a culture. You know, Chinese people had foot binding, the developed world had slavery. We had all these things that were quote unquote part of our culture, mm-hmm. but we let them go once we realized that they don't make sense anymore and they don't fit with our values. And, you know, just last week, Britain passed that law so that women can inherit the crown. And that is, again, to match the values of today. But having said that, when I first started Shark Truth, I think I remember a friend actually asking me if I drank shark fin. And she kind of asked me in a way, like, because I'm Chinese and she was Caucasian. She asked me in a way that was kind of accusing me of doing something wrong before I knew what she was asking me. And so, you know, I understand when groups say, you know, this is attacking our culture. I understand the place they're coming from because it doesn't feel good to have a finger shaken at you because, as I mentioned before, most people just don't know. And if you just yell at them and scream at them, that's really not a way of getting the point across. And consumers play a huge, huge, huge part of this issue in terms of because it's the demand that's fueling this product. Mm. But, you know, they're only one group. And so not all the blame can be laid on them. And I think that's where the discourse has been happening in the public arena, is that there's this kind of blame laid on Chinese people when, yes, we do have a responsibility, and yes, we can stand up to take leadership. And this is what me and all my teammates and all the wedding couples are doing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we have to be conscious, you know, that all cultures have its food problems. It just so happens that this one's with the top predator that is very, very important. And it just so happens that the main people that want this product is only Chinese, right? Mm. So we tell, you know, if we could, we would tell all people to not eat shark fin, but there's a very specific group of people that eat shark fin. So in that sense, we're not really targeting or attacking. It's just that, you know, it's smart marketing.
So, I mean, it sounds like the ecological effects are first and not specifically that this is a Chinese tradition.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's definitely around the ecological issue for me and all my teammates. You know, growing up in a traditional Chinese family, I love the Chinese culture. It's so rich. It's so diverse. And what I remind folks is that because our culture is so beautiful and deep, removing one dish is not really going to let it fall apart, right? Mm. If that's what you think, then that's very sad.
Yeah.
We have so many things to be proud of. We're a collective people. We have a strong sense of community. We have big hearts and, you know, we're generous. And in that way, we just have to remind ourselves that some things that don't fit with these values, they can go away. And that's okay, because cultures that are smart change and adapt.
Hmm. Now, I'm wondering if you can respond to a full page ad that I'm sure you've seen that was taken out by the members of the Toronto Chinese Business Association. And in the ad, they claimed that the, well, at the time proposed bylaw would be an unfair and irresponsible act. Mm-hmm. And they asked why shark fin should be banned in the city of Toronto when everyone else in Canada can consume and possess any other shark products. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they end the ad with the statement, be rational, not emotional. Yeah. Can you respond to that ad and the claims by the Chinese Business Association?
Yeah. I mean, the main reason why sharks are killed is for their fins. A dorsal fin, which is the top fin of a whale shark, which is the biggest fish in the world, can go up to $50,000, just that one single fin. So that gives you an idea of the extent and nature of the trade is mm-hmm. that sharks are, everything else is worth either pennies or nothing. There was a reporter from the Toronto Star that actually went to a shark fishery in China. And the CEO admitted that, you know, 70% of the revenue comes from fins only. Everything else is almost like a byproduct. So to be strategic, we look at fins first to protect sharks. And if we can control and maintain that trade, then we have a huge part of the problem solved already. So that would be my response to them. And it's very well known that, you know, everything else of a shark is not worth a lot, especially the meat, because some species have shown to have pretty high mercury content. Mm. And shark meat in general is not very tasty. There's only a couple species that has high demand. But overall, of the 450 species of sharks, everything else is worth relatively little. And I mean, if we could, if meat were the big problem, then we would also look at that too. But right now, finning is the most urgent problem. And that's why we're strategically looking at that area of the issue.
Hmm. I'm reminded of bear dancing in India and how that was completely eradicated. You know, families were sustaining themselves by having, you know, a bear who had a hook through his nose, and then when you pull on the string that's attached to the hook, then the bear dances. And that was largely eradicated by providing people alternatives to support themselves. And, you know, we are talking about the Chinese Business Association, and, you know, we can't ignore the economic motivation. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, has there been any effort to sort of work with the folks who are relying on finning to sustain themselves? Or, I mean, can you give us some insight into what that industry actually looks like?
Mm-hmm. So there's two parts in terms of the economy. The first part is with the fishermen themselves who go shark finning to make a living and put ends meet on the table. And so, you know, what we try to work in solidarity with is encouraging governments that have large finning nations to provide sustainable alternatives in terms of the industry. So there's been reports that have been recently released, actually, with economic measures around how much a shark is worth alive in the long run versus how much a shark is worth dead in the short run for shark fin. And of course, the long run wins because the sharks can be used for shark tourism. And when you have a tourism industry, it's something that can be sustained for a longer period of time versus, you know, killing a fin and then shipping it to wherever to be consumed. So that's the one part of the equation. The second part of the equation, in terms of working with the restaurants, you know, in Vancouver, there's been restaurants, big banquet restaurants too, that say, you know, Sharkfin makes up only about 5% of their revenues. So if there's a ban, they could really care less. There's one very big restaurant named Sansoiwa, which is likely in the top three of Chinese restaurants in Vancouver, that have come out and said they support a national Sharkfin ban. So people are beginning to realize, at least restaurants are, that you know, we shouldn't have shark fin anymore. And what I say to the restaurants is also that any smart business always comes ahead of the curve. The business that are able to capture the market that's growing is the most successful. And in this case, if you know a shark fin ban is going to happen either now, soon, or later, why wouldn't you just come out and say, we're going to be the first restaurant to take shark fin off our menu? Because there's a growing group of conscious consumers that will be loyal customers to businesses that make conscious decisions. And so if a business was smart and they actually cared about their economic success, they should take that risk to come out and be the first.
You mentioned shark tourism as sort of an alternative. What do you mean by shark tourism? Because often we think about this debate in two sides. We have the side that's for exploiting the sharks, and there's the side that's against shark finning. But there's actually, I mean, there's a third perspective, and that's the perspective of the sharks, right? So I'm wondering what you mean by shark tourism, and would shark tourism sort of take into perspective the interests of the sharks themselves, or is that possible?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think the point here is, you know, we need to have the sharks to be alive. And with the amount of finning going on right now, this is our best bet. And by shark tourism, I mean, you know, going diving with sharks and snorkeling with sharks. I myself went to Mexico a couple months ago to an island called Isla Holbox, which is very famous for whale shark plankton feeding. Oh. So, you know, we went snorkeling with the sharks, and you're not allowed to touch them. And they have very strict rules, at least with the touring company that I was with, to make sure that, you know, the sharks are, they have their own space, and that you're not, you know, bringing them more harm than good. And of course, if you do any diving, if you do any type of tourism, whether it's for sharks or for any animal, always do the research to make sure that the company is doing their due diligence and that that they have the right, you know, environmental and social standards too. Mm-hmm.
So when couples win a trip to swim with the sharks, these aren't sharks that are kept in pools and...
No. The first year, the couple that won, Ty and Juliana, they had 680 people at their wedding banquet. They went to Mexico and they swam with 100 whale sharks. And it was just during a high plankton feeding time. So the sharks are already there because they're feeding on the plankton. And they just kind of dove in and snorkeled around them. 100 whale sharks is a huge crowd of sharks. So that's what they did. Yeah.
Well, and I mean, I think that starts to break down a little bit of the barrier as far as the bad stigma, the bad rap that sharks have gotten too, right? Breaking down some of those assumptions that they're really dangerous and terrible and just want to eat us all.
Yeah, I mean, like, the funny thing is that, you know, just because an animal is dangerous doesn't mean we have the right to decimate their populations, right? Like, first of all, there's only a couple of species of sharks that are aggressive. And even if they are aggressive, who says we have the right to, you know, remove them all from the oceans? You know, tigers attack people, elephants attack people. They kill more people each year than sharks do. But, you know, there's this stigma, like you said, around sharks that, you know, they're these kind of brainless killing machines. But sharks are very charismatic animals that are really smart. And they're so majestic and misunderstood. Mm-hmm. Whale sharks have no sharp teeth, and they mainly feed on plankton in the ocean, but they're the biggest fish in the world. And they have this kind of square box head, little spots. You know, I call them, if they were, you know, in the family of sharks, they're definitely the grandmother that forgot their dentures, just gumming their way through the water. And, you know, being next to one of these animals just really, really, really takes you into, it's the closest you'll ever be into another world, because it's just truly an amazing experience.
Claudia, we only have a few minutes left. I'm wondering if you can look forward for our listeners and tell us what's on the horizon for Shark Truth.
Yeah, so each year we run this Happy Hearts Love Sharks Wedding Contest, and we're just organizing that again this year, and we'll be launching that later in spring. We'll also be working on a shark fin band campaign. We've been doing it kind of behind the scenes for the past couple months, but we'll be publicly launching it very soon. We're just launching a petition today. So if you go to change.org and search Shark Fin Free Vancouver, you'll find petition on that website, or you can go to sharktruth.org. And so those are the two big things we're working on. We're also supporting MP Finn Donnelly, who's a member of Parliament of New Westminster Coquitlam. He's introducing a bill very soon in the next 2 weeks to ban shark fin imports on a national level. So we're supporting him in doing that. We might organize a couple movie fundraisers, or movie screenings, I mean, and do a bit of outreach and education to the community. So there's lots on our plate, and if anybody's interested in helping, you can also visit our website for more information. We're a volunteer-run group. We're 20 people, and we would love to have more passionate and dedicated individuals join us.
Wonderful. And we'll have all those links that you mentioned up on the website when this interview goes to podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, Claudia Lee.
Thank you for having me.
You are listening to Animal Voices here on CIUT 89.5 FM. That's all the time that we have for today. Stay tuned for Raw Sugar.